Discover how to have a more playful life. The Playful Life Podcast, here we go. With Anthony Traher as your host.
Hello and welcome to another inspiring episode of the Playful Life Podcast. Today we have the pleasure of hosting Juzette Lovemore, a lifelong advocate for human development, transformative learning, and the power of play. Juzette has authored numerous journal articles, 5 ebooks and book chapters, as well as co-authored 6 print books with a focus on building relationships with children that promote optimal well-being. Juzette teaches graduate courses at Antioch University in Individualized Masters of Arts and has been educating adults since 1992. Her work pioneers how adult and child grow together. Juzette Lovemore is honoured that her book, Grow Together, Parenting as a Path to Wellbeing, Wisdom and Joy, has earned the prestigious Mum's Choice Award. Enjoy this episode. Unlocking human potential through play and learning. Juzette, so it's really a great pleasure for me to have you here.
Well, it's an honor to have been asked, and thank you so much.
And to connect with folk like yourself that have really a long history with play and playfulness and everything that comes into that sphere. And one of our aims in this podcast is really to help people realize why invest time in play and playfulness, you know, why it's not frivolous activity, why it's actually really good time invested.
Oh yes. You know, it started for me when I was invited to come and speak. Different schools would ask me to come and speak. My field is human development, and primarily in the early days I focused on the natural learning relationships of children with their environment and how important creating the appropriate environment for the different ages of the children and their development. And the one of the key schools that would ask me to come were preschools. And the reason was that parents were asking for more academics in preschool and less play. Mm. And I was like, oh my goodness. Play is so important in preschool children. There's brain development happening during play. There's cognitive development. There's social skills that are developing during play. And, you know, the primary work of play is learning. And so children in preschool that's their job, is to play and learn through play. And so many wonderful things are happening in the brain. So children develop in relationships with each other, in relationships with the adults in their environment, and in a multitude of different ways. And so encouraging people to allow their children to play, especially in preschool, but in all of the educational grades, there's appropriate ways to play that is very important to learning. And even as we get up in the into the upper grades, helping children remember that it's very important for the brain to not always be focusing, but to have downtime. And so play is very important to healthy development and learning, even in the higher education, that it's important to punt, so to speak, or to have downtime. So I think play is important throughout life.
Yeah, brilliant. So when we're talking about play means a lot of different things, so a lot of different people. Are we talking more about sort of more spontaneous play or self-directed play? Or
well, all of the above. There's many different kinds of play. Imaginative play develops the thinking areas of the brain, and this leads to really a greater ability for the child to have be innovative and to self-regulate. There's innovative play, in which we allow children to play and create their own internal world and explore the world, whatever world they can create, and conquering their fears while practicing their, you know, roles that they play in life. Play helps children develop new competencies. But the catch is that when an adult directs the play, it is not the same for the child. The benefits of play are not actually realized as when we allow children to direct play. So oftentimes I will encourage parents to get on the floor and play with their preschool age children and say, tell me what we're going to do. I'm here to play with you. Tell me how we're going to play. And children have no problem telling you your lines and giving you your toys and telling you what you're going to do. And then the car goes over here and the doll goes over there. And then she's going to say this and I'm going to say that. So we know that with knowledge, you know, with understanding how children develop and grow is important, but also letting children lead the play is very, very important. But with knowledge of how children develop, we adults have a better opportunity to increase our own competence in our parenting skills. We have the opportunity for better communication with children in our lives. We can even have fewer conflicts. It improves our expectations of what children are capable of at each age and stage of development. But still, in all, Different age children are capable of different kinds of play. So, for example, a lot of adults are very keen on the rules of play. And actually, children aren't really that keen on rules until maybe age 7, 8. I mean, really young children, they're just imaginatively creating their worlds. They're not going to necessarily sit down and follow the rules. So we really want to be in relationship with letting children allow their perspective to emerge and watch how perspective changes as children grow and play in relationship with that perspective change accordingly. So little young children, very difficult to follow rules. I mean, you put a board game on the floor, and mostly what they'll do is stand on the board game and play around in the way that they normally play, which is all imaginative. But as children grow older, they're going to get very upset by that. So if we want to play a board game, we're going to have to put it up on a table. And really, if they want to follow the rules and do that kind of thing, that's for an older age child. But for early childhood, play is a way of exploring their senses as the child makes sense of their expanding understanding of their world. And like from around the ages of 8 to 12, play involves more social interactions and more cognitive development. And play really promotes connections with each other, problem solving, skill development, social skill development. And play can become a medium to work through stresses and to just have fun. But from 13 onward, play is more centered around games and rules, like I was saying. The child grows to understand boundaries and limits. And oftentimes when I play with kids 13 and older, even though we might start with a set of rules for a particular game, pretty much halfway through the game, they'll start creating variations of their own, which is really fun to see what kinds of variations they create. And they'll be pushing the limits at the same time of sort of following the rules, but now making it more interesting for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. And this drives adults potty, right? Many adults.
But you see, when the child is in the company of somebody who really cares and is really willing to swing with their creativity, then the child feels supported and they can become, their imagination is accepted, and it allows them actually to be more imaginative and to become more resilient in their world, because they learn they can, you know, they're trusted and they can rely on their inner resources.
Okay, this is brilliant. So this is one way of like keeping this natural play disposition that we have, growing up as children, but lots of us didn't have this sort of welcoming approach to us growing up. And so how as adults can we sort of regain what we have lost? Do you feel it's...
Well, that's a really interesting question. A lot of times when in the days when we did workshops, parents would come in and we'd talk about, you know, the perception of the child and how to, the importance of playing with this age child and how to play with the different age children. And sometimes we'd get a parent who would come in and say, I have no idea how to play. I was not allowed to play when I was a child. My school was very academic oriented and was not play oriented. And I had responsibilities when I got home from school. I don't have any idea how to do this. And I would say, no problem. Your child knows. So here's what you do. You get down on the floor and you say, teach me how to play. How would you like to play? And the child will give you lots and lots of information on what they want you to do. They'll give you, you know, mom, you say this, and now you do that. And the truck goes over here, and then we go over there, and then the doll jumps over the fence this way, and then they talk to each other, and then they, and the child will direct the play. And child-led play leads to the most creative approach. And it's very good for memory improvement, for cognitive development, for it creates problem-solving abilities. It enhances the child's ability to pay attention. It increases language skills because they're learning and playing as they go. And it's actually, believe it or not, play stimulates better math skills. Without focusing on math, these, especially when we allow children to play imaginatively with blocks and build things and create things, the relationships of sizes to each other, all kinds of math skills are learned there without theory. And then later on, when we start teaching them some of the basics of math, they have ability to be receptive to it. So there's lots of different kinds of play, but if we let children show us what they would like in play, we don't. Actually, we shouldn't really direct the play all the time.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And what about people that don't have children?
Yes. What about? What do you mean? What's your question?
How can they regain playfulness in their lives?
Well, there's so many different kinds of play. There's a functional play when a child uses their senses with emerging physical capabilities in a way that gives them sensory feedback from their world. So a lot of times little children, and especially infants, will play by repetition, making something happen over and over and over again, making a sound over and over and over again. And this feeds back information into their sensory development of their brain. Children 2 and above, they begin to use objects to construct something new, like a matchbox can become a boat or an airplane. And that's very constructive and it's symbolic. And it allows children use that to very important for developing a constructive center of the brain by making new things without a goal, without an end product, but just imaginatively creating things. Mm.
This is really hard for adults. Really hard for adults to do things without rules. You know, just having.
And that's the good part about asking our children to direct the play. It's like they'll tell you that's a boat, and you know the concrete adult will say no, that's a matchbox, and say no, but now pretend it's a boat, mom, because we're gonna, and then the doll's gonna get in the boat, and that kind of thing. And then there's dramatic or pretend play where the child invents ideas and invents symbols and invents feelings, and it allows children to role play without, the child gets to create the story. and gets to invent the dialogue. And that's really valuable to cognitive learning, language learning. So many things get stimulated there.
And a lot of emotional processing.
Very much so.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, pretend play promotes divergent thinking, which is very creative, very open-ended. It generates multiple solutions to problems. Even the ridiculous is allowed in play. And that's the fun part of play. There's like the boundaries are open, and, you know, you give a child a feather and some sand and they will create mountains and all kinds of things and create their own problems and create their own solutions to those problems, which is beautiful.
Brilliant. So I just want to mention that I came across your work, Gisette. I was a friend of mine gave me a permaculture magazine from 2003, and wow. It was all about the 00 zone, which is like your inner world for permaculture. And anyway, I was looking through this, and I came across your book. It was in here, like, as one of the recommended books, the win-win games book. So when we're talking about rules and creating rules for games, for our play, could you just tell us a little bit about the principles of win-win games?
Sure. That book is in its third printing, believe it or not. And New Society Publishers contacted us a couple of years ago and asked us to write a new introduction and to write a few more games to expand the book a little bit. So it's been a very popular book over the years since we first published it. Gosh, I think it was in the 70s, late 70s. But I'm not positive about that. But at any rate, it went through its third printing. So what we did for the introduction is we offered people an understanding of how children's perception of their world and perception of themselves changes throughout childhood, and how then play should be allowed to change with the child. So then, you know, for the very little child, we see social development occurring during play. Like, if some children will be very involved, or uninvolved rather, and just watch from the sidelines, and then they'll might play by themselves. We call that solitary play, or they might be onlooking, where they observe others playing, and then they play alongside other children, but they're not necessarily playing with the other children. But and then they start to be more interested in one another, and start playing with other children, being more interested in the relationship with the other child more than the rules of the play or the toys even aren't that interesting. It's about what they do together that becomes more interesting. And then we start to see them evolve into cooperative play, where children start playing together and co-creating rules of games. And that's wonderful. And really needs to be allowed by the adults in the situation as they increase their social skills. So by allowing the child to go from uninvolved play all the way over to cooperative play through those stages of play in social development, that takes time. And the child will do that at their own pace. Some children will do it rather quickly within the first few years of life, and other children might take longer. But they will go through all those different stages. And as the child grows, for example, social relationships become much more important, ages 8 through 12, and how to develop friendships, and how children start caring about the feelings of others, and how to organize and develop trust in relationships. And that's, play comes in really handy for helping children organize and develop trust. And as I said earlier, then around 13 or so, children start they'll play by the rules, the rules become much more important to them, but they'll play by the rules of the game, and then they'll start creating their own rules, offshoots, variations. So play evolves, and the type of play that children will engage evolves as children age and grow throughout their childhood years. And so we put that a little bit of information about that in the introduction because we felt it's really important for people to understand that the way the field in which children know their world changes as they grow. And if we can swing with those changes and start creating environments that support those changes, it creates resilience in children. It's
Brilliant. So what sort of adults emerge from having played a lot as children in this like evolutionary way?
That's a good question. Well, we might say that the optimal circumstances would be that the adult would have a sense of place in themselves and place in the world, would be grounded in their relationships with their children, and have a sense of trust in themselves and trust in their children's feeling and feeling relationships with others. They would be able to guide children rather than lead children. That's a very big difference. They would have a developed sense of self where they felt not cemented to an identity, but a little more fluid in our identity relationships, in the to be able to call upon identities within ourselves that are relational to the environments in which we're in and the children with which we're playing. And be at a certain point, not so invested in our defending our identities in the world, but willing to be challenged and not feel that somehow by being challenged, we're losing a part of ourselves if we don't defend the identities that we've created. So I don't know if that answers your
Yeah,
question, but
no, totally. I often say that generally people's favorite game is the game of being right.
And I think that's the fault of the educational systems that we grew up in. That if you were good, if you had the right answer, you were good if you were raising your hands with the right answer, and that's not necessarily the most imaginative, creative way to live, and that was the way we were raised.
Yeah, we're talking here about developing our brain. It's not just about having fun, even that's a big indication that we're on the right path, I feel, when something is enjoyable and pleasurable. So could you talk a little bit about brain development and also this relationship between academia and play and yeah, let's stop
You
there
know,
with
that's
that.
an interesting question, academia and play, because if you think about academics, what we are doing is we are studying the field in which we choose a field of professionalism, we choose a field of study. For example, my field is human development. And we study the theorists that were former. Came who were in our field who formerly sh in part shaped our field. But the meaning everyone makes out of each person makes meaning out of the theories that we read about in our unique way. I mean, you have to stay true to the theorist and to the originator of those theories, but yet at the same way, academic papers are constantly taking shape and bringing forth new knowledge in relationship to former theorists. And so we're using that information in a very playful way. Now, not to create the ridiculous, I'm not saying that, but it, to be true to the theorists that we've studied, but still in how we utilize that information and how we bring it forward in our work and our research. is a very creative form of play. And we thereby create new knowledge. So in essence, I think academia is playing with knowledge constantly. To
sure.
create new knowledge. But, you know, and then, of course, I know that we can get very stuck in defending our thesis, in defending our dissertations, in defending our theories. We have to defend them correctly. But still in all, if you think about it, that's a form of play as well. And it doesn't have to be... A tense relationship to defending ourselves. So, you know, play can nurtures emotional growth and our feeling connection in with humanity in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I feel, you know, like the great academics, like I don't know, I just think of like Richard Feynman now, you know, this physicist. They seem very playful. I think there's a level that you get to where you really do feel like you. It's not like a struggle. It's obviously a brain effort, but it's a pleasurable brain effort, and you're relating it to your life somehow. There's always a connection back to your life. When the academia separates from life, I think that then. It
yeah.
can be a bit stale somehow.
Yeah, I know. No. Creating theories to stick on the shelf are useless. I mean, we really want to create theories or create knowledge and create meaning that is relational to the needs of our world, and be attuned in the relationship with humanity. I think that's the most useful. And I'm not original in that thought. I mean, that other... human developmentalists have said such, that the most useful theories are the theories that are relational to everyday life and useful in everyday life and can be integrated and used by humanity.
Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant. So I want to just talk a little bit about play and playfulness and mental health. And just how you see like the causes of like mental health problems now, and what role could play have in it, and could have had more when we were younger. And I'm not talking about like extreme issues, perhaps just we like sort of lose ourselves a little bit perhaps.
That's an interesting question, and I don't think I'm not sure. I'm definitely not an expert in diagnosing mental health conditions. It's not my area of expertise. I can say a few things about, and I say nothing in relationship to biological inherited things that are passed along family lines. I really don't want to make a comment about that. But what I can say is that when children are valued and given their developmental needs as they grow, and environments are created where they can explore their healthy development in a positive way, that they feel valued, they feel seen, they feel heard. And that creates healthy self-esteem. It creates a movement toward well-being and a movement toward actualizing our innate capacities, capacities that we are born with, but need relationship to come to the fore, to come out, to be given their full breadth of expression. So when children are nurtured in this kind of way, I have seen that they access those innate capacities, what's available at each and every different age, and they access optimal well-being. So learning what is innately available at each age of childhood and how can we create environments that draw out that innate capacity where children can play in safety within that environment and access what's naturally inside them. That's the optimal situation for accessing well-being. I think that's the best I could say in terms of mental health, and because I really, there's so many really complex things when it comes to.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I'd like to go a little bit more into perhaps it's a funny question. It's like, what sort of myths do you feel that you've come here to put to one side? Like,
that's a really good question. When my husband wrote his book, here, I'll just pull it out here. Nurturing a Child's Consciousness, the Natural Learning Relationships and the Roles of Parent, Educators, and Caregivers. In the back of his book, he wrote a whole section on the myths that people create in relationship to children. One of those myths, misconceptions about children is children should be seen and not heard. You know, you take a child into an environment, let's just say you have bank business and you have to go to a bank and you've got little children with you. And the misconception is that they're going to sit quietly and not disturb anything, when in fact, that is not developmentally within their capabilities. They're going to play with, there's these velvet ropes that, you know, that are in these banks, and, you know, to cordon off the lines and where you're supposed to stand. And children play with those ropes. Of course they're going to play with those things. They're going to play with all the little pieces of paper that they can write on. So the misconception is that children should behave in a way that quietly and sit still and sit in their seat. No, they have to get up. They have to move around. That is a misconception. Children are always going to play by the rules. No, they're going to create their own rules. And that's a very, very good, creative and important aspect of their imagination. That children should automatically, like the children on the playground, should just get along. No, they have to be guided. They have to be related to. They have to be... trust develops in relationships. So we have to do those kinds of things with children. And those learning how to trust is actually something that can be learned in play. So there's a lot of misconceptions that I recommend somebody looks at in the back of this book. Let me see if I can find the page here, read some of those things to you. While I'm doing this, do you have another question you want to pose?
I think this is quite interesting. I'm quite interested in finding out like how this all began with you as well. How did this passion for play and also this thing about learned seriousness why it actually squashes playfulness.
I don't know. I honestly don't know why people invest so heavily into being serious. And I just think it's the way we're taught. And making mistakes, helping, you know, I led in, my daughter and I, when she was alive, led an art class together. And one of the biggest and most important things that we did in art was to make mistakes okay. That a mistake leads us to another opportunity to build something out from the mistake. And that we learn from our mistakes and we can create new things from our mistakes. And that a mistake doesn't necessarily define us as a mistake isn't an end to a process. A mistake is an entryway into a new process. And so, but so often we are taught our mistakes mean we're bad or we're doing it wrong. And that's a misconception right there. that mistakes define us in a way that says, oh, we've done something bad and wrong. So mistakes are doorways into a new creative process. And giving children permission to make mistakes was really hard for some of the kids. It's like, oh, they would tear up their paper. They take their drawing and they tear it up and they say, oh, it's wrong. And we'd say, no. Let's smooth that out. Let's see what can we do from there. How can we go from there? And one of the biggest mistakes I think families make is to see children as separate from the family in which they grow. That somehow, if the child is having a difficulty, then the child is the problem. Whereas children have difficulties in growing, then we as a whole family can reorganize to address what's coming out in that particular child. We can address it as a family situation, not as making the child the identified problem. And thereby
what
the child...
What does that look like, Gisette?
Well, for example, if we're seeing... we want to teach our children, for example, to participate in family chores. I get this from parents all the time. Well, then start young. When you start doing chores, do them together. Don't be making them like go do this thing over there all by yourself. No, let's go take the garbage out together. Let's take the compost pail out together and make it fun. Let's put on music and see how fast we can clean up this room in 10 minutes to the music and make it a fun activity rather than a chore activity. Let's dance as we play, and then if we ask children to dust, for example, we don't go afterwards and say, "Oh, you did it wrong. You didn't dust properly." No, we have to start doing it together, so that the child learns from the close proximity to the adult in the situation, it's done, and then as the child starts to individuate, which is the teen years, they'll want to go be able to do it themselves. Just the other day, just yesterday, I'm participating in raising my two grandchildren for a wide variety of reasons. But my daughter died of cancer about 4 years ago. And my son-in-law is living, we live together, we're a five-person family. Anyway, long story short, my granddaughter decided she's making a new bedroom for her high school years. She's entering high school, the second one. And she decided she wanted to shampoo her rug. So I showed her how the machine works, and I left her to it. And she was adamant that she wanted to do it herself. But if she were younger, we would do it together. But at this age, she's 14 now, she pretty much wants to do it on her own. So it was just a matter of showing her how it works, and now she's off and running. But you would not do that with an 8-year-old. You would not do that with a 6-year-old. You would not do that even with a 9-year-old. You would do it together until they felt confident. Once the confidence builds, then they will say, "Okay, I want you to go now. I'm ready to do it myself." So you let the child lead again, those kinds of things. Some of these misconceptions, I found the page finally.
Okay, brilliant.
Don't assume that a child sees themselves as separate or immature. Children see themselves as connected to us. Don't believe that the child's personality is determined by the first year of life, by the second year of life. The children have, we actually, our personalities are developing and growing throughout life in the relationships we hold. It's a misconception or a mistake to believe that frustration or dysfunction or is a proof of separation, actually, or to support verbal, linguistic, and logical, mathematical intelligence more than any other type of intelligence. And here he's referring back to Howard Gardner's seven intelligences that I think evolved into 8 or 9 intelligences, that there are many, many different kinds of ways of perceiving our world, verbal, linguistic, logical, mathematical, but also bodily, kinesthetic, musical, and that different humans perceive differently and verbal linguistic and logical mathematical aren't the only ways of perceiving reality, although they're quite heavily rewarded in our educational systems. They aren't the only ways that children perceive. And so to only reward those ways of perceiving and performing is a misconception about childhood. It's a misconception to neglect the hidden aspects of human nature, the shadow aspects of human nature, especially teenagers start to bring that to the table. And so we want to, it's a form of playing with identity construction. And so we want to allow our teenagers to express that in a healthy way within the family context and the family system.
What would that look like, Gisette?
Well, I mean, we would invite children, different outfits they start to wear in relationship to their social world or the music they want to listen to. We listen to it with them, or maybe even go to the concert together with them. I mean, I went to a Kendrick Lamar concert not too long ago, and that is not necessarily the music I was raised with, but it's very, very fascinating, interesting lyrics to this music, and it opens up a whole exposure to a new world that the kids were interested in. And you want to know these things. You don't just shut it down. You go play in their world, and you get to know more about them. So you play with their music. You play with their, allow them in their costuming and their all black or whatever it's going to be. It doesn't matter. That's their shadow expression. Or we want to it's very important to not think that sibling rivalry is natural. Now, I understand that siblings do have, you know, their tiffs and their arguments about this or that, but it's not necessarily a given that it's natural. But we want to allow for that kids to move through that with appropriate relationship and not get stuck there. So, and it's a misconception to make kids dependent on rewards for certain behaviors and punishments for certain behaviors. Again, we want to guide that with relationship, not with rewards and punishments. So, those
brilliant. Thank you, Gisette. Let's bring our conversation to towards an ending. Is there anything you'd like to say to the people listening to the podcast right now? Is there some?
Oh, that's so kind of you to say. I would say learn child development. Learn how children develop and grow. Learn how their field of knowing changes through their developmental years, and build environments that draw their innate capacities forward. And this, it's beneficial to parents. It's beneficial to educators to create classrooms that are relational to the developmental age and stage and field of knowing of the children involved. And I think open up the relationship so that you can enter into the child's worldview and guide from their innate capacities out, rather than imposing our adult rationalizations down. It's not top down. It's a relationship of entering the child's worldview and engaging them there.
Brilliant. Brilliant, Gisette. So you've written lots of books together with your husband, and
they're all available on Amazon, by the way. All of them, they can be acquired there.
And where would you like people to find you online?
We have a website www.lovemoureconsulting.com. You can find us there. I teach courses through the Transformational Learning Foundation, and that can be found online by looking up. Let me find theirs.
Yeah, I'll put these links in the show notes.
I teach courses through Antioch University in the Individualized Master of Arts program. I teach courses through the Transformational Learning Foundation. We have several books on Amazon that can be looked into. I'm sure we're in libraries, and if we're not in your community's library, you can ask your library to get the books. This way you can borrow them. And then our website.
Thank you.
And good people like you who ask for interviews.
Yeah, no, I really, I'm really tuned into the power of playfulness and just how it changes, just how completely changes our lives.
Well, it's wonderful that you have this as a focus and that you're bringing it forward in these playful ways. And it was delightful to engage with you in this topic. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Josette.
Discover how to have a more playful life. The Playful Life Podcast. Here we go. With Anthony Traherre as your host.
If you're interested in bringing more play into life, then please hop over to anthonytraherre.com and download your free Playful Life Design Starter Kit, which is a PDF called Burn Your To-Do List, and a four-week Cultivating Playfulness mini course. There's audio and video in there. And so see you there.